So have you ever been just completely tapped out in a circumstance and looked around and just thought, man, I am just getting beat up. Where is God in the midst of this right now? Have you ever been through something like that? I have many, many times. Shocker there. Been through moments where I just say, oh, what do I do now? I am exhausted. I'm tired. Early on in our journey with getting LifePath started, we traveled, Bethany and I traveled down to Atlanta to take just a little bit of a retreat with some other pastors and continue to learn, but just kind of get some sacred space to just reflect on how things had been going so far. And we were pretty exhausted. This was pretty early on, and we had wanted to see some things happen that weren't quite happening yet, and we were in the middle of that. And during the time down there, I was introduced to a man named Buddy Hoffman. And Buddy had been a pastor for decades by this point. There's Buddy. Maybe. There's Buddy. And I met Buddy, and they hosted us for an evening. He and his wife hosted us at their house, and we had dinner together. I only met him this 1 week, and he had planted one church outside of Atlanta that had grown to 7 different campuses, and really a wild story. But he was this grounded person, and we started talking about what was going on and the challenges of ministry, and I told him just about how hard it was sometimes to keep faith when some of our gatherings were so incredibly bad. We had, and some of you that have been around from the beginning, you know we had some really bad gatherings, right? And it was just rough. It just there was not a lot of energy, didn't feel very inspired, weren't necessarily meeting people. And Buddy said, he just kind of chuckled, and he said, yeah, he said a couple things. The one thing he said, when we got started, he said, there were times where I preached so poorly that I got done after our gathering, and I said to my wife, he's Southern, so like when they talk about church gatherings, there's a lot of like preaching centeredness, which is not a problem, but this is just the way he talked. And he said, I preached so bad that when I got home, I told my wife, I said, nobody's going to come back. And she said, they'll come back. And he said to her, I won't respect them if they do. And he told me, he said, hey, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. And that stuck with me. I saw in Buddy someone who was so grounded in God's faith, regardless of whatever the challenge facing him might be. Have you met people like that in your life? Who seem to walk with a consistent awareness that Jesus is at work no matter what it looks like at the moment. What does it look like to get to that point? Sometimes ministry or family situations or relational connections have felt just like kind of slogging along to the point of resistance that there was just not a lot of forward motion happening. So maybe you've experienced some of the similar circumstances in your life and you just wish God would intervene and do something crazy. 2 weeks ago, in the book of Mark, he did. We talked about the boat. The disciples are in a boat. Jesus is asleep, a storm comes up, and oh, it's just this crazy moment. They wake up Jesus, it's this Jonah parallel in many ways, and Jesus speaks peace to the storm, and it is a monumental moment, right? And the storm and the raging seas calm down, and they're filled with awe, and this lesson is that Jesus has authority and power over land and sea. Jesus is the God of all creation. And when we cry out to him, he does what only God can do. So 2 weeks later, and 2 chapters later, we are once again in a boat with the disciples. This time, however, Jesus is not present, and the story is very, very different. So just listen to this. I'm not going to throw it up on the slides yet. I just want you to hear. Now, right before this story, here's what had happened, and we're looking in Mark chapter 6. But right before this story, Jesus had sent his disciples out to go kind of proclaim the good news of the kingdom, and they had been doing that, and they had come back and given their reports, and there was some exciting things, and I'm sure that they were processing some things that didn't work real well. In the midst of it, however, Jesus' cousin and one of the most respected prophets of the entire biblical narrative, John the Baptist, was killed. And so the disciples also bring this news back to Jesus, that this kingdom that John had been helping prepare people to receive had taken a major blow. And it's incredibly disappointing, and the disciples and Jesus are exhausted. And so they set out across the water, the Sea of Galilee. It's not that big, but to get away for a bit. They get to the other side, and the crowd that Jesus had been helping to heal had grown so much that they got wind of what was happening, and they were there ready to meet them. They just wanted a break. And all these people show up, and Jesus does what Jesus does. He has compassion. And so this is the moment that we get the story of the feeding of the 5,000. So there's hardly any resources there. The disciples don't know what to do. Jesus challenges them to have a little faith. And then blesses, breaks, and gives. So this has just happened. The disciples are still not having a chance with Jesus to really mourn everything that's gone down with John the Baptist. And they're starting to see that this journey is full of a lot of ups and downs. And so here's what happens in the book of Mark, chapter 6, verse 45. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida, where he dismissed the crowd, After leaving them, he went up to a mountainside to pray. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. All right. There's a few strange things in this story. I don't know if on first reading or first hearing you pick them up. But there's a couple things that are rather peculiar about this telling. Anybody catch any of them? Two in particular. What do you think? Jesus made his disciples get in the boat and go ahead. That's not rhetorical. If you just want to call it out, I'll repeat it here. But made his disciples get in the boat and go ahead. While he dismissed the crowd, after leaving them, he went up onto the mountainside to pray that night. The boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. Okay, let's just talk about one thing. Anybody want to give a guess about where we're going? Phil?
Well, immediately tells them to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus seems to want to get them out moving on the water. And maybe we can have all sorts of conjecture about what that is. Maybe Jesus needed alone time, right? You know, he took that a lot, space to be away. But yeah, he sends them out. The timing of this is an interesting story. Later that night literally means in the evening or when it was evening. It is the first watch of the night. There were four Roman watches of the night. The first one was from 6 to 9 p.m., second watch of the night was 9 to 12. Third watch was 12 to 3 a.m. And the fourth watch of the night was 3 a.m. to 6 a.m., okay? We good? Okay, so literally this is referring to, there is no question about this, later that night, or the direct translation is when evening arrived, okay? So sometime up to about 9 o'clock at night, the boat was in the middle of the lake and he was alone on the land. Here's what happens then. He saw the disciples straining at the oars, because the wind was strong against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. Anything peculiar there? He waited a long time. Literally, once again, in the original language, it says, on the fourth watch of the night. Fourth watch of the night. 3 to 6 a.m. Sees them straining. 9 p.m. 6 hours. Working at the oars, straining against the wind. Jesus is aware. This is a hard, confusing moment for us to be reading. What on earth? The last time we're in a boat with Jesus, he gets woken up and he stands up and he says, "Shh, storm." He shushes it. Remember 2 weeks ago what we talked about? He shushes the storm. He rebukes it. He says, "Peace, be still," like correcting a child. Fascinating. This time, we get a whole different ballgame shortly before dawn. We're just going to leave that there for a moment. And we're going to talk about the next thing, because this is what everybody wants to talk about. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. All right. This is an interesting story. Jesus has done miracles before. You know how when we talked about how Mark loves to embed all of this Old Testament imagery, where Mark doesn't explicitly say things. Mark wants us to figure out the kind of underlying hidden themes that are in his book. He's the most straightforward, simple writer of all the gospel writers, but his stories and the things that he tells has more imagery from throughout the scriptures than you could argue any of the other gospels do, okay? So here's the thing. Walking on the water is a really big deal. You have images throughout the scriptures of the Spirit of God hovering over the waters, but you only have one reference during the entire Old Testament where there is anything like this, talking about anything, anybody, any idea that is related to walking on the water. And it's in the book of Job, Job 9:8. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. It's the only time you get any type of imagery that's this explicit, okay? And who is he alone being spoken of? Yes, Job is waxing eloquent at this point about the nature and character of God. Job is talking that there is certain things that only God can do. And so right off the bat, once again, we get this image that Mark is wanting us to see, and once again, he had a Jewish audience originally that he wants them to see, that underneath all of this, Jesus is once again doing something that only God can do. No great prophets who had done great miracles had ever walked on the water. Even like the big guy Moses, water moved out of the way so he could walk on the land. But walking across the water, this is something that only God can do. All right. So, he went out to them walking on the lake. Do you see anything else that's strange in this story? Absolutely fascinating. He was about to walk by. This got to be comic, right? So Jesus, they're straining at the oars. Jesus decides to go on a walk, and he's just going to walk by. You know, like, maybe there wasn't another boat around. He needed to get to the other side, just like the disciples. And so he just said, I'll just walk on by. Is that what's going on here? Because it's an absolutely fascinating statement to say that Jesus was about to walk by. Now, some theologians have argued that this is because we are to see that Jesus never imposes himself on people. That's actually incorrect. But I don't know. You can debate if that statement is correct, but that's not what's happening here. We're told clearly in the Greek, his intention was to walk past them. Okay? All right, so here's what we get. His intention was to walk past them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they'd all saw him, and when they were terrified. Okay, we talked about what Mark loves to do, right? Jesus is intending to walk by. We can only understand the depth and the beauty and the challenge of this passage if we understand a little story that happened in Exodus 33. In Exodus 33, Moses is talking and speaking with Yahweh. And Moses, Yahweh, the God of Israel, Moses is talking with him, and he is saying, Moses is very discouraged at the time. And he's being sent into this to lead his people into the promised land, but they're kind of exhausted. Moses feels alone. Aaron's not leading anymore. And so last time, Moses was given Aaron as like a partner to get things done. And this time, Moses says, hey, who are you going to send me to get things done? We're kind of exhausted here. Moses said to the Lord, this is Exodus 33:12. You've been telling me lead these people. Listen to the tone of Moses. But you've not let me know whom you will send with me. You've said, I know you by name and you have found favor with me. If you are pleased with me, teach me your ways so that I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember, this nation is your people. Don't forget. By the way, in January we're going to talk about covenant in the biblical themes, and that's covenant language. That's something someone could only say if they were in covenant with someone. And so we see the people that God covenants with relating to him by even being rather bold and sometimes rather harsh and what we might say is inappropriate language to God. Actually, we don't say that here, but some people might say that. We think we can be honest with God. "Remember, this nation is your people." The Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." So Yahweh says, "I will go with you. My presence will be with you during this journey ahead." Here's what he says immediately afterwards. "If your presence does not go with us, don't send us up from here." It's like a kid that asks his parents for ice cream, and when they say, "You know what? We'd love to give you ice cream," he says, "Why don't you ever give me ice cream? God has just said I'm going to go with you." And the next thing Moses says is, "If your presence doesn't go with us, don't send us up from here." God says, "Hey, did you hear what I just said? I will be with you. I will do," in verse 17, "the very thing you have asked, because I'm pleased with you and I know you by name." Then Moses said, "Now show me your glory." And here's what God says he will do. "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you. And I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." And the story goes on, and he hides Moses in the cleft of a rock. And the presence of God passes by, and he shields Moses' face from being able to see the face of Yahweh, but he sees his shoulder, his back, as he walks by. It's this fascinating story, and he gives Moses reassurance that he will be with him, that his presence will be going with him on the journey ahead, because he knows it's going to be a hard one. Okay. Here's where it starts to get really, really fun. The phrase, "I will..." Where are we at? Sorry, let me get to the previous slide. There we said. Oh, no, here it is. "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you." That phrase is literally, "I am going to walk past you." The Hebrew, the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, and then it was translated into what we call the Septuagint, into Greek. In the Septuagint, the phrase that is used of walking past is the exact same phrase that Mark uses. Exact same wording. He intended to walk past. So what does Jesus do? He plans to walk by. To walk by in such a way that reveals his presence and gives the disciples assurance for the journey ahead. But what happens? As he intends to walk by, what happens? They don't recognize him, right? They think he's a ghost. They get really scared. They saw him and they're terrified. They don't recognize him. Ready for this? This is where it just, I love this stuff. Okay, do you remember what we talked about in the book of Job? That little phrase? Okay, all right. He treads on the waves of the sea. Check out the rest of the passage here. He's the maker of the Bear and the Orion, the Pleiades and the constellations of the south. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. When he passes me, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. Same phrase again. Same phrase again. Job is talking about how there's something about the nature of God and the ways of God that often causes him to be missed, even though he is walking right beside him. There is this moment where the disciples, they miss. And Mark wants us to see that the nature sometimes of discipleship, the nature of Jesus working in certain ways is mysterious, and it's hard to grasp and it's hard to understand. And sometimes when Jesus is right there with us, we cannot perceive him. Theologian and author Richard Hayes says this: "Thus in Job 9, the image of God's walking in the sea is linked with a confession of God's mysterious transcendence of human comprehension. God's passing by is a metaphor for our inability to grasp his power." And so, like Job, the disciples appear to not recognize God as he passes them by. I'm looking for one thing. I see another. And I miss him. This is real life. The Spirit is near, but I don't know what I'm looking at often, and I don't know where to look. So they don't get it, right? They freak out. And then what happens? He saw the disciples. They cry out because they saw him and they're terrified. And then what happens next? Immediately he spoke to them and he says, what? Take courage, it is I. Some translations might say, take courage, I'm here. But guess what? In the book of Exodus, when the Spirit of God or the presence of God passes by Moses, he proclaims his name and he says, Yahweh, Yahweh, slow to anger and abounding in love. A few verses later of the ones that we looked at. The word Yahweh. Anybody know what it means? It means I am. It is a statement of presence. Sometimes talk about God as the name of God being the great I am. In Greek, I am is a little, here we go, a little phrase that goes something like this. Ego, a me. Ego, a me. I am. Jesus comes and we translate it as take courage, it is I. But what Jesus says is take courage, I am. Jesus comes. When they do not recognize him, he proclaims his name in their presence. Step two, in order to reassure them, in order to help them understand what is coming and give them strength. And they still don't get it. Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid. We know that that doesn't really work because they still are afraid. They didn't understand. Amazed is filled with terror, also translated as. So we get this moment where Jesus intends to walk by them to reveal his presence in a certain way. They don't get it, so he speaks his name in the exact same order that Yahweh does it for Moses and in the same name that Yahweh uses, I am. They still don't get it, so Jesus finally changes his plans and steps into the boat with them, which is such a hopeful moment for those of us who are disciples of Jesus. When the disciples are thick-headed, Jesus says, I'm going to work with you anyways. He steps into the boat and things calm down. Now, we are not given any clues that his intention was actually to calm that storm. His intention was to walk past them, to give them strength for the journey ahead. Remember, they had just learned that one of their own had been killed, John the Baptist, preparing the way. Jesus knows that he's not going to be with them forever, not in the same way. He will be with them forever, but not in the physically present sitting in the boat. And so he sends them out on the water. And he's praying while they struggle. He's praying. And then he goes out to meet them to reassure them of his presence. And they miss it. And the reason that they miss it is because their hearts were hard. That word literally means they're covered with thick skin or calluses. Their hearts were covered with a thickness. It says they didn't understand the loaves. They thought the loaves were a nice miracle, but they didn't understand that Jesus, like Yahweh, again with Moses, right, in the bread miracle was providing manna for his people in the desert, in that moment, that he was promising his presence to lead them into a different type of freedom and toward a different type of promised land, right? Rather than the temporary freedom from the Egyptians, Jesus is leading his people toward freedom from sin and all that corrupts the heart and the soul. And rather than a physical promised land, Jesus is leading them to the redemption of the earth and to a place where they would live with him for eternity in complete oneness and relationship. And where Yahweh had once told Moses that Moses could not look on his presence and his face, Jesus faces his disciples and steps into the boat. In every way, we are to see that things are changing, that God is revealing himself in the fullest and most personal way imaginable. Now, let's not be too hard on the disciples. They did not have the privilege of seeing the whole story. They're allowed to be more thick-headed than we are. We get it. We get to read the whole story and then look backwards and say, idiots. We get to do that. Not quite as easy when you're actually in the boat at that moment. But the final and biggest question remains, why really? Why wait so long, and why intend to walk past and not just stop the storm? It goes back to the words of Jesus that he spoke, take courage. If the disciples had ears to hear, one of Mark's key phrases that he uses throughout, they would not just be relieved that Jesus wasn't a ghost like they thought. They would hear the divine name spoken, and they would experience what Moses experienced, which was an assurance of God's presence even in difficult times. And they, like Moses, would be assured that this was the God who would go with them on the difficult journey ahead, even when miracles are denied. Jesus' message here is you need to have faith that I am God and that I am with you, even when things don't resolve quickly. That will give you strength for the long, hard journey ahead. I will reveal myself to you, but I won't always save you from whatever hardship you're facing. This is a bit of a hard pill for us to swallow sometimes, because it brings us face to face with an uncomfortable reality, and that reality is that maybe saving us from any struggle in the here and now is not to our greatest good, and it's not God's greatest priority. Now, that's a far cry from God causing evil and struggle to happen in our lives, and we want to delineate that very clearly. But it's hard to deny that the moments that are the least desirable in our lives for us to experience are the moments that have the potential to shape us in the most profound ways. I'm going to say that again because it's probably important. The moments that are often the least desirable in our lives are also the moments when we can be most profoundly shaped in Christ-likeness for the good. And frequently, it's not till we've suffered, it's not till we've come face to face with our brokenness and our finiteness and our pain, it's not till we've endured that struggle that we're able to grasp the transformative presence of God when we're fighting against the wind. We can't really grasp it until those moments come. So, if we learn to walk through the struggle with honest conviction that we need not fear because Jesus is with us, that we need not fear because Jesus is with us, that truth changes lives. It gives us perseverance. It gives us joy in the midst of heartache and patience in the midst of affliction. We know later that there's times where Jesus decides not to do a miracle because it's not what would be most beneficial at the moment. Here we can kind of conjecture that because everything points to the fact that that was never his intention, was to calm the storm. It's an afterthought. In the book of Mark here, and Mark's, every gospel writer tells their stories with a certain emphasis because of what they're seeking to help us see. But in the book here, we do the walking on the water and the calming of the storm as the big points here, and those are both actually rather minor. The big points are what Jesus is doing when he wants to pass by them and what he speaks to them when they think he's a ghost. So, here's a couple of potential takeaways that you might have, and then I'm going to wrap up with a simple story. The first, and we do this because there's many things that might be stirring in you right now, but sometimes when we do narratives and just tell the stories, it can be hard to grasp onto something. So maybe something like this will grab you and you can reflect on it further, or maybe it's something that's not on this list. But possible takeaways as we look at this story is that God is present when life is hard, even if we have eyes to perceive. That sometimes in the midst of the struggle, indeed God is trying to reassure us by coming near. But we have to have eyes to see, and we have to have eyes to perceive, and it takes time. Sometimes, here's a hard one, disciples need the assurance of Jesus' identity and presence more than they need another storm-stilling miracle. Sometimes disciples need the assurance of Jesus' identity and presence more than they need another storm-stilling miracle. Remember, again, I'll say it, John the Baptist had just been killed. They're reeling from all of the experiences, and they're not sure what to do with the weight of it all, and they need to learn how to trust, because the journey ahead is not going to be an easy one. Having the conviction that the great I Am is interceding, knowing who God is and that God is present, maybe that is the most valuable information we could ever possess in our entire lives. Maybe that's what helps us not throw in the towel during the journey of faith. Third thing, perceiving Jesus in the midst of our struggles builds perseverance for the journey of life. If we learn to actually perceive and look for Jesus in the midst of our struggles, we will find that we have the strength to be able to continue, and that we have the strength to face even larger struggles when that might happen. Jesus tells his disciples in the book of John, take heart. You'll have trouble in the world, but take heart because I've overcome the world. Notice how he doesn't say, take heart, I'll fix it for you. I wish he had said that. But he says, I've overcome the world. Just keep that in mind when you are in the midst of the struggle. That's not the whole story. That's not the whole perspective. And the final maybe possible takeaway is this story can relieve the threat of a faith crisis when God doesn't rush to do the miraculous. Sometimes we need to be reminded that Jesus is the one who stands up and rebukes the storms. And sometimes we need to be reminded that Jesus is the ever-present God watching over, even interceding, as we fight against the wind. Those are both part of the ways that God works. If we can understand that, then when we long for God to do something and God doesn't do what we want to do, we don't lose our faith. And that matters. Because sometimes we set ourselves up where unless God works in the exact way and rescues us from the situation in the way that we long for it, that's the only way that we can understand God's faithfulness. The story's bigger than that. I told you about meeting Buddy Hoffman and that week that I was encouraged by him. In January of this year, Buddy was diagnosed with an infection in his aorta that was incredibly aggressive and only given a couple weeks to live. During that time, Christianity Today came and interviewed him to get a little bit of his perspective. It's a 15-minute long interview. We're not going to look at it here, but I am going to show you about 45 seconds so that you can get a glimpse into Buddy and just share a little bit about how he actually impacted me.
You're talking spiritually, I'm doing wonderful. If you're talking socially, I've never seen so many friends. If you're talking physically, I think that's not going too well.
No, if we really believe that this thing that is in front of us is so amazing, that we're going to see Jesus face to face, then there is absolutely nothing that can compare to that community.
I decided not to show very much. I just wanted you to get a glimpse into Buddy and his heart. Buddy died February 12th, exactly 1 month after he was diagnosed, 11 days after this interview. I saw in Buddy's life and in death, and I didn't find out about this until after he'd passed away, because we'd only spent a week chatting. I saw in his life and death a rock-solid reality of Christ's transformative presence in the midst of a heartbreaking situation. Buddy always said, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. That was his way of thinking that transferred not just into like ministry challenges, but an entire way of life that said, I'm going to continue and I'm not going to give up whenever the hardness comes because there's something way bigger and way more beautiful at work. He wasn't afraid of the struggles and the frustrations because he trusted that God was present and it's going to be okay. But I'm guessing that Buddy's ability to trust and perceive Jesus as he passed by on the waters wasn't something that occurred right when he was diagnosed. I'm guessing that it was something that came from years of learning to look for Jesus in the struggle, years of learning to have eyes to see in the smaller storms so that when the struggle came that lasted all night, he was able to have real faith. And that took training. This is what happens when we see that Jesus is both the one who calms the raging storms and the one who reminds us of who he is even when the storms continue to rage. It's transformative. Perhaps it's no surprise that Jesus, when he sends his Holy Spirit, he calls him the Comforter, right? not the fixer all the time, but the comforter, because there are going to be times where the struggle is real and we are going to need to be reminded and comforted in the midst of it. So my hope and my prayer for you this morning is that you would have eyes to see, that we would all have eyes to see and perceive the Lord as he walks by on the water, even if the winds are raging. God's goodness is not bound to our physical current circumstances. Oh, thank God for that. It's a great truth to grasp. Okay. I'm going to throw a quote up as we share communion in just a moment from Brennan Manning, and there's another quote that'll be on the screen too, but I want to read this to you so that you can begin reflecting on it, and if you want to just take some time to pray as we share communion, that's great. Brennan Manning in his book Ruthless Trust says this: "I used to believe that trusting God's goodness meant I would not be hurt. But having been hurt quite a bit, I know God's goodness goes deeper than all pleasures and pain. It embraces them both."